You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome to this week's edition of Blue Republican Radio. This is me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican. Now, many of you who have kind of been following this movement for the 3 years that it's been going now are likely to know that Blue Republican really came out of an attempt to reach those on the left. It was an article in the Huffington Post that I wrote that kind of triggered this whole nine yards. And that article was written specifically for those who voted Obama, identified liberal, because, of course, they're the people reading the Huffington Post. And I was suggesting that these voters, people who supported Obama, and, you know, I did in spirit in 2008, so, you know, hand up, guilty, that they should be true to their truly liberal principles, if that's what they had, of being for civil rights, against crony corporatism, and for peace rather than war, by joining the Republican Party to try and get Ron Paul on the ticket for the Republicans in 2012, having seen everything that Obama had done in his first term. So that was how the Blue Republican movement was born, outreach to the left. So today I have a very interesting guest that I have enjoyed talking to on the phone over the last few weeks. We haven't known each other long, but he has an interesting and relevant background, particularly relevant for what we're trying to do at Blue Republican, because my guest, Rahul Varshney, comes from the organized left. Indeed, he was an organizer of the left, having worked for 7 years at the Service Employees International Union, been a lead organizer of healthcare workers in South California, and of city and county employees in Texas. And I just love kind of his journey towards liberty and some of his ideas about what we need to do to get to many of what I guess in the country that I come from we would simply call a lot of the working class, but more broadly the kind of politically disengaged and disenfranchised voters in our country. Because as liberty lovers, these are people that we really obviously need to be reaching out to and getting their support. So Rahul Varshney, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you for having me, Robin. Glad to be here.
Now, just so tell me again, when was it that you crossed the Rubicon from the left to liberty, or do you want to even take issue with that characterization?
No. It's you captured it actually in the talking about the 2012 elections and that whole looking in the mirror, you know, understanding that I voted for Obama in 2008, campaigned for him. I was in D.C. actually at the inaugural balls. We snuck in. Hopefully Secret Service isn't listening. But
they are listening to everything,
you know, and I was all up in the hype, hope and change. And then 4 years later, you know, more war. And furthermore, discovering the role of fiat money, the Federal Reserve System, and this sort of corporatism. I was finally distilling the difference between a free market, between capitalism and crony capitalism or corporatism, and the imposition of force to get things done.
See, perfect. This is the journey we all want to, you know, we want to get everybody on from kind of the progressive left into liberty. So
Absolutely. Now,
when did you kind of make that journey? What year was that?
Well, I would say that it began with the Arab Spring, Twitter and all that, and I was just getting really into what was going on. And then from there, you know, Occupy came about, and of course the Tea Party is going on this whole time. And one thing I noted down here is that, you know, in underserved communities, which the Rio Grande Valley is one of them.
Which is where you live, Rahul, right? Just to be clear for our listeners. Yeah.
Exactly. Right along the border here in Texas, we don't have the luxury of division that maybe some areas do. And what I mean to say is that you know, after a few of these Occupy McAllen meetings, we had people from Tea Party McAllen coming over, you know, and at first it was this big thing, do we let them in, do we not? And then it's like, what, who are we to decide, you know, like this is the community. And then a few of us went to some Tea Party McAllen meetings and we realized that we're all talking, you know, corruption is corruption. You know, you can paint it this way or that way, but the root is the same, you know, which is ignorance, egotism, greed, a lack of accountability, really. And so, you know, that's what brought about that sort of change within me.
So when you were, so you were kind of frequenting meetings, Occupy and Tea Party, and then you started reading some Ron Paul, is that right? Like, what, how did that all get incorporated?
Yeah, so in 2008, to just take it a little back, I had heard about Ron Paul, but, you know, I was a bit more, gullible, I guess. And so when he was smeared with the whole racist newsletters, I just said, oh, there you go. You know, that's why, you know, libertarianism,
That was an easy out for a lot of people, wasn't it, in the face of what Ron Paul was.
Absolutely. And then in 2008, I was still more of big government can take care of us. We just need a huge, massive railway system and employ everyone, you know.
Yeah.
And so by 2012, I got past that sort of barrier. I looked deeper into Ron Paul's message, and then I picked up his book, End the Fed, and then, you know, Von Mises, Rothbard, Mystery of Banking. And so things started to, history started to make sense to me. I finally felt like I had a role, a positive role to really play in this greater drama that was unfolding.
So so what did you see that role as being? Was it to draw on your experience, you know, working as an activist on the left?
Yes, that is what really motivated me to get involved with Occupy. I was living back here, moving back here to raise my son. The union was no longer around, so that wasn't a job for me, and I was searching what to do, and then all of a sudden this call for Occupy, you know, comes out, and I just knew innately that my role as an organizer, as someone that, you know, wanted to bring the community together, I had to stand up for what I believed in, you know, and I also had to point people away from the typical traps of the left, you know, the socialism, communism, Marxism, the, you know, we're just going to pass this policy and redistribute the wealth and it's all going to be kumbaya, you know, and I needed to say to people, wait a minute, this is a train wreck, you know, we need to get off this.
Now, those kind of things, was that something that you were surrounded a lot by as an activist working for, you know, like the SEIU, et cetera? I mean, was it real? Is it really still there? That kind of mentality?
The closet Marxism.
Yeah, or maybe even not the closet, but, you know, the on the bright urn on the mantelpiece. I mean, I don't know.
No. This is a good discussion to be had. I think, well, let me say this. The leadership, I would say, of most large organizations in America, the leadership, whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit, it's the same type of Washington, D.C. mentality, which is we're going to tell you what it is and you're going to do it. You know, isn't no democracy.
Top down.
But the word we used, the code word, was organize. We organize the staff into this decision, you know.
I kind of just like that. Organize a group into a decision. I don't think I've ever heard that expression, but it kind of says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was like, you know, what are we getting for lunch today? Well, let's organize the staff around pizza, you know? But now, this is what gets interesting. Coming to Texas, it's a right-to-work state, and so we had a different dynamic to deal with. And I will just jump back. This is way back when I first got into unions, there was a fellow from Arizona. Sorry, I'm skipping around here. But
so good.
Arizona is also a right-to-work state. And within the labor movement, at least within SEIU, right-to-work is this, like, heretical, like, oh, my God, how could you even suggest? No, it's all about closed-shop unionism. And for your listeners, just for them to understand, the difference basically is in a right-to-work state, workers can join or drop their union at any point in time. They're not bound, right? Whereas in closed shop, it's like a cell phone contract. You know, you sign up, you're in for the year. You know, you're in till you're employed at that, your duration of employment. And the point I'm trying to get at here is this revolution or revelation of voluntary association that in Arizona, what I was told is that, you know what, it might be right to work. Not all the workers are in the union. But you know what? The ones that are in, they actually want to be in. So we're getting people that right. want to do it instead of the ones that we're forcing to do it.
And are the flavor of the unions clearly very different between, you know, those that are voluntary and those that are closed shop? Do they operate differently?
Yes, I would say so. I've never worked in, well, I don't know how to put it. Let me give you an example, I guess. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW, they have a different model. They just have a different way of, it's not the workers versus the boss. And, you know, different things come about when you have voluntary association. And that really is the heart of capitalism, the voluntary association of wealth. And that is actually what a true union is workers coming together, voluntarily pooling their money, and then, you know, democratically deciding how they can benefit from that, but not to go attack the boss. And this is a melodrama script that mimics a lot of the left versus right, you know, false paradigm, I would call it, that has been put in front of us.
Okay, hold on to that thought, because we'll come back and discuss this more after the break. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. I am speaking to my good friend Rahul Varshney. Rahul, you were saying as you went into the break, you were talking about the playing out of this kind of false left-right paradigm as you've seen it working in the unions.
Yes, it's basically an us versus them mentality. That's what gets created. And whether it's worker versus management, worker versus boss, left versus right, poor versus rich, it is not productive. It's not pragmatic, and it's not progressive. It's retrogressive. It actually, you know, takes the organization and the union members backwards. And really, I could sum it up like this. It's a turf war. What I see in the labor movement today and what I see largely in politics today, and I was just recently involved, actually, with some local candidates here in Hidalgo County, and their whole political operation was based around the frequent voter. And I can understand that when it's close to election time, but it seems as if no one is really thinking about the masses, right? And just for some clear numbers, about 10% of the American workforce, the private workforce, is unionized. So that means 90% is wide open, but no one's really planning for that 90%. They're all fighting over the existing 10. And I would
now. So you're talking about what people who are trying to get support for unions, for union membership, are focusing on 10% of the 10% who are already union members. Because obviously, you know, normal candidates are not limiting themselves to the union voter base, unionized voter base. So just be clear. What exactly are you talking about here?
Right. So two different paradigms. So within the union bubble, the existing big unions only focus on the already existing workforce that's union, which is 10%. And then in the political paradigm, it seems to me that candidates largely focus on existing voters. Like, there's not really a big drive to register new voters or just talk to students about politics who can't even vote, you know, but engaging them in politics. So that kind of broader appeal is what I think is missing and is what brought me to Blue Republican, is what brought me to you.
So tell me a little bit about that. How does Blue Republican fit into that?
Well, Robin, your discourse is absolutely astounding. And I mean to say that your voice, it's fresh, your writing, it's fresh, but more than just, you know, the talent, it's the way you communicate. It's the fact that you speak, I'm at a loss for words here, but you speak from a position where you're respecting your audience, you hear different views, you know, differing views, but then you just go back to your position. You know, you don't, I don't ever feel any sort of division when I read your stuff. I feel more enlightenment, and that is where I want to be today. I want to convince people by sharing the truth with them, right, and not by telling them, oh, this is, don't you know, this is how it's supposed to be.
So you're talking, I think you're speaking to my point about, you know, it's easier to sell something to someone if you do it without making them wrong before you start.
Yes.
Right. Okay, well, I appreciate that, and thank you for those kind words. Now, I want to make sure I kind of get this in the context that you're putting it in. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that approach, you think, has a special value in actually engaging people who are heretofore just completely unengaged or disengaged. Is that right? That this is the way to actually broaden the pool of people who are, or at least may be, interested in our message.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So now this is because of the community that you live in, right? You live in a community down there close to the border with Mexico, where you see basically a large majority of people who are just completely on the side of our political processes.
Yes, completely apolitical, you know, could not even name, I mean, you know, really just outside the political process.
Now, so why? Why are they?
Well, there's some demographics to consider. Outside of Bronx County, Hidalgo County has the largest amount of food stamp recipients. So we have a very big welfare community down here that has just grown up on government handouts one way or another. We have...
You know what? I want to ask you about that. Yeah. Now, a lot of people listening to this are going to go, well, they're lost. You know, how does the Liberty Movement, you know, bring those people in who have been so dependent on the state? Like, a lot of people are surely going to be thinking they are the last people that we can grab. Now, you don't see it that way, right?
No, not at all.
So tell me why that's wrong, because this is what I think is, you've got so much value to add to the discussion here.
Well, there's some favorite phrases, and I may be paraphrasing from the Bible here, but it's, let's see if I can get these right. The last shall be first, the first shall be last, and the meek shall inherit the earth. And so some of these people that have been on welfare have been living in a, you know, servant-like condition or just being dependent. They yearn for independence. And sometimes on the outside, we don't see that, because obviously if you ask a poor person, you know, do you need some help? Do you need some money? They're going to say yes. They're not going to say, oh, no. No, only private charity, please. Keep that government handout to yourself. You know, they're not going to give you what you want to hear on camera. However, if you actually get to know the community and you live amongst the community and you see what artisans are struggling with, you see what local farmers are struggling with, you know, you go to the events where there's farmers markets just, you know, trying to get off the ground, then you hit the red tape on the local level. And these people might be on welfare, they might be on food stamps, they might be in government housing, but they don't want to remain that way. No one wants to stay stuck on the system, you know, and that goes back to that false left-right paradigm where the false, you know, the left tries to make that image that, oh, no, you know, there's no other way. And no, indeed, there is a much better way, you know, and that's through liberty.
So how would you set up, if it was up to you to do it, a positive and empowering welfare system? I mean, what would it be? Would all welfare be time limited? Would it be, or is it almost that it kind of doesn't matter what the welfare, how the welfare system is set up, because we are not doing any of these things that we need to do to deregulate local government, state government, etc.? I mean, what would the changes be that you would make if you could?
Well, that's a great question, Robin. And so this goes back to the voluntary association of wealth and creating a what I like to call a charitable marketplace. You have to create a sustainable sort of system for people to give. And down here, this would be something natural. There's already an organization, Infinite Love. I can just mention it. They feed the homeless. I mean, they get together and they do things, you know. And of course, there's many churches down here doing many great things as well. To the point about, you know, what would we do with welfare? Would it be time limited? I'm saying that in this new world we're cultivating, there's so much voluntary association going on.
It's what you're saying. There's already a lot happening, and we need to improve what's there.
Yes, and the core, this is what I'm realizing, whether it's you know, we're talking about Blue Republican or we're talking about any group out there that's really trying to make a difference, the core is the volunteers, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes Blue Republican great. You got, you know, we've got a great team, right? Sorry, I don't mean to reveal.
Well, we'll come to that, yeah.
And my point is how do you make it sustainable, right? So welfare, actually, when you put it in the hands of the community, becomes a great sort of thing. I mean, giving should be fun, right? That's the whole thing. Our system is so upside down. You know, the tax man has created such a burden on us that it's very difficult for people after their paycheck has been whittled down to then go, oh, now I'm supposed to go help? You know, I barely have enough for my family, right? So this is really about inverting the pyramid for me.
What does that mean?
Now, when I say inverting the pyramid, To me, it's like within the left, they may think I'm nuts, right? But we have this thing called a progressive income tax that I really believe is retrogressive, and, you know, where you end up paying.
Well, hold on. We're going into a break. We'll carry on from there when we get back. Rahul, when we went to the break, you were beginning to talk about how our progressive tax system is actually retrogressive, to use your word.
Yes. And really, actually, the whole progressive era of the 30s, out of the Great Depression, that whole thing was retrogressive, right? We just perverted this word progressive. And I had something written down here that I'd like to share. For me, libertarianism, as Ron Paul has taught me, boils down to these three things. Number one is self-defense. Okay, I have to preserve myself. Number two is community defense. All right, my community. Number three is then non-intervention. So as long as one and two aren't being violated, right, I cannot intervene in affairs that are outside of my jurisdiction. And then the fourth thing happens, which is that market starts to actualize. Trading starts to happen. And to me, Robin, a true progressive, and I want the listeners to hear this, a true progressive is rested on a libertarian foundation. And so if you ever get into an argument with someone spouting off, you know, old school, whatever you'd call that progressivism, you know, you can just say, wait a minute, you know, and you can say, Raul Varshney told me, if you're not rested on libertarian principles, you're not a progressive.
And if Raul Varshney says it, it must be so.
Must be so. There you go.
Just before we move on, but what about the obvious yeah, but, right? Because the yeah, but is, well, that all sounds fine, but this leaving things to the market, to voluntary private charity, there's always going to be some that fall through the cracks, and it is right to have a safety net. And that safety net, therefore, you know, the state is the, quote, guaranteed, can guarantee the safety net. And therefore, the resourcing of that safety net, essentially by force through the tax system, we have to do that. And that therefore is part of a progressive society. What's your answer to that?
Well, and within that, there are some fallacies, right? So we say government guarantees. Well, FDIC, right? Federal Deposit Insurance. I mean, really, what is the guarantee behind that, right? It all goes back to, I guess, guns, you know, guaranteeing this system. But then you said something else about resources. How can you have the proper allocation of resources when you don't have accountability, right? And in a government system, you lack that sort of accountability. And also what I want to be clear, you know, because of the yeah buts, right? Part of this is a challenge of vision, all right? You know, there's a song I like, Warren G, Regulators, okay? And what that, it's an old school hip hop song, right? But what that song to me is about, that the market itself, and this is what people have a hard time fathoming, that when you start organizing the market, right? And for me, the last 100 years of America have not been true capitalism, right? So I don't think any of us have really experienced, we've experienced bouts of it, okay? But what I'm trying to get at is that when the whole community, a place like the Rio Grande Valley, okay, the 956, when the community starts coming together, then all of a sudden we have a neighborhood watch going on. All of a sudden we have a farmer's market going on, right? All of a sudden the churches are putting together picnics. And what happens, Robin, is these organizations, these communities, the actual community now says, you know what? We all need security. We all need a safety net. We all have members of our community that struggle and hit bottom. So what type of welfare system can we build that is accountable, that separates out the abusers from the ones that actually benefit? And notice now what's happened is that power has been localized. It's been taken from D.C., and put back into the hands of the people, and that's what I talk about when I mean inverting the pyramid. Right. This is the bottom-up revolution. Have no doubt, right? The revolution is here, and it's blue Republican.
Well, that kind of begs another question. So, now, I have actually written, I mean, I've written about this directly. I wrote an article called America's Not Faring Well on Welfare.
Right.
And it covers some of the exact ground that you're covering here. But I'm guessing that that's not what you read before you became, quote, a blue Republican. So what would you like, with everything you've said in mind, what would you like to see blue Republican doing, and more broadly, those who identify in the liberty movement, what should they actually be doing? You know, when they're not having arguments on Facebook, what is it that they really need to be doing to bring people, perhaps through our actions rather than our words, to our political paradigm?
Right, that's a great question. And it reminds me of Ron Paul having his, you know, he'll have people on and they'll ask him the same thing, you know, what should we do? And he actually, you know, he says, look, politics are great, you know, political office will come, but get involved in the community. And so to any of the listeners out there, you know, press the easy button. You've got a group of people you play cards with, or you've got, you know, maybe at your school, there's different clubs. And I'm not saying you go in there and all of a sudden you're preaching to people, but what I'm saying is take the free market, take the principles of voluntary association, take Robin's discourse, study his writings, listen to his interviews, see how he carries himself, see how he does not lose his cool, you know,
Well, it's, the truth is, Rahul, when I lose my cool, I just do it in private.
Well, you know, that is a sign, though, of a gentleman, of a professional, of a new sort of political paradigm. And I want to bring America out of the darkness that we see in the mainstream media, where it's always tit for tat, it's always, you know, gotcha questions. Right, and actually create this new platform. I just tweeted this yesterday, okay, that, YouTube is about to take over television. You know, we are now taking over the TV, and we need to understand what that means. That means that we should all be carrying ourselves in the highest level of respect, so that when I tweet, when I post, I imagine, it's not true right now, but I imagine this message might reach 7 billion people, right? So how do I want that message to come across? And that helps me, you know, carry myself a little better.
Now, to this end, you resonate a lot with this message that I draw the distinctions among and relationships between purism, principle, and pragmatism.
Yes.
And I'm very skeptical of, I think sometimes people are kind of being purist and they're dressing it up as being principled, but actually they're not. And I think what you're saying kind of, I think, it fits in here somewhere.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I will borrow a page from the 12-step programs where they say principles before personalities.
Okay.
And, you know, here's a simple one. If you are repeating yourself more than twice in a conversation trying to convince someone, lay off. You know, just let them have their say. And, Robin, you said this in a previous discussion where people don't care about my issue. You know,
right.
I've got to care about their issue. And
right.
I want to share that tip with people from the labor movement, all right? Mary Kay Henry, current president of SEIU, would always tell us as organizers that the number one complaint of union members is that the organizers don't listen, right? They want to tell us what the issue is. We're the ones in the struggle. We know. And so those people that are outside of the liberty movement, right, let's think about it. Okay, why are they outside of it? Well, there's some ignorance there, but they're also going through something. What are they going through? How has the welfare system affected them? Do they enjoy waiting in line to get their food stamps? You know, that's not a dignified position, but they're not going to share their struggle with us if we are coming across holier than thou.
And it is a tough one, that one, isn't it? Because we in the Liberty Movement do rightfully have a moral objection to the current state-delivered, centralized, federalized welfare system. We
yeah.
have a moral objection, and but yet we have to, and we can't kind of be dishonest about that, but yet we have to talk to people who are the direct beneficiaries of this system from against which we oppose in various ways morally. Now, how do you do that, Rahul? Do you know what I mean? Because it's, how do we come at someone when they know that's our position without having them feel accused or morally put down by us? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I would take it, I'm thinking about the Matrix now, right? I mean, we're talking about people that are plugged into a Matrix and we want them to take this red pill, right? And so we have to think to ourselves, okay, well, how do we prepare them for it? How do we bring them to that conclusion? And then, you know, I'm not telling someone that's on welfare right now to go drop it. No, what I'm saying is let's build a better system. All right, while this current system exists, let's discuss and cultivate a better system. And trust me, Robin, Occupy wants a community solution. Look, there might be whatever left Occupy Wall Street taken over by big interests that's shoving some democratic agenda, but the people on the ground, they don't know who wants to depend on Washington, D.C., ultimately, right? But yes, to talk to someone that is in the system, I think you have to just maybe agree to disagree, right? And say, hey, you know, you're on it, you're dealing with it, right? You know, but not have to necessarily get into that, right?
Isn't it a completely kind of valid and consistent position to say, you need to survive, you have been made somewhat dependent by the society we live in. We want to change that society, and you have every right to say that you will only come over to our own side when we have actually built this society that enables you to do so without starving, without losing your home. But then the question becomes, surely it's going to take an awful lot of people, an awful lot of time to be able to get local welfare, voluntary welfare in place to an extent that enables us to actually undo the massive federalized welfare system that we have. I mean, aren't we really saying that we're taking on this huge task, in which case, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is if I was a welfare recipient, I might say, well, good luck to you, Liberty guys. Let me know when you've done it. And I'm going to think I ain't going to be hearing from you for another 20 years. Do you know what I mean?
Right. And, well, now I'm thinking of an old neighbor of mine. He's since moved with his family. But this guy, Ray, very nice guy, he was on Medicaid, diabetes. He had ulcers, a bunch of health issues. At the same time, Robin, he was a very talented mechanic, right? And he had a great service to offer. So then, you know, I can approach him two ways. Am I going to talk to him about his current lifestyle and why it's wrong? Or am I going to tap into his strength?
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Something that I'm finally learning, that we can cultivate people's strengths and then leverage those strengths into addressing their weaknesses.
Now, you see, this speaks to a weakness of the federalized welfare state, which is that you know, the state, Washington, D.C., can't speak to individual strengths because, you know, it's too crude. It's a one-size-fits-all thing, right? This is obviously a huge fundamental problem of the welfare state that I've written about at length. But it also points to a difficulty for us, surely, which is there have to be so many of us to be able to have these conversations with the so many different individuals with different skill sets, different backgrounds, etc., that need our help, that need us to engage with them. I mean, is it feasible? Let me ask you that. Do we not have to grow so many times, you know, by a factor of 10, 20, 100, before we can even begin to do this on the scale that's going to make any difference?
Well, it's a work in progress, obviously, right? But that's what excites me about revolution, that there's a tipping point when, you know, the masses will be preaching this. And, you know, it's a lot of it's monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's all good.
That's right. I mean, that is, of course, true, that when you can see, when you can build something successfully in one community, nothing then succeeds like success, right? You show it. You don't argue it. You just go do it. And of course, the structure of the United States is when we can do that at the state level. We can, you know, the laboratories, right, the governmental laboratories effectively at the 50 states, we can really make it work that way. So you lead by example, right? That's what you're saying, lead by example.
Yes, Robin. And can I add one more thing to this welfare discussion?
Mm.
So really all of this charity, welfare, it, you know, boils down to two groups, okay? There's a buyer's group and there's a seller's group, meaning there's people that need charity. They don't know how to provide for their family. They're struggling with food, whatever it is. And then there's people willing to provide, right? And so organizing those two networks and then furthermore having a competitive marketplace,
right,
to get those two. And that is something that DC fails. They have these no-bid contracts, right? And it always goes to the crony. So this is very doable on the local level. We have the technology now that we didn't have before.
And speak a little bit about how to reach, in particular, immigrants who are completely at the side of our political system. You live in a community with a lot of Hispanic immigrants. Is that right?
Yes, over 86% Hispanic population.
Is there anything we need to know about engaging that community in particular?
Absolutely. This is something that became apparent to me when I was getting involved with Occupy McAllen, that there were people, quote unquote, on the left that had their small businesses, but they were under the radar, right? And Ron Paul even talks about this, that, you know, if you want to see how the true market functions, just look to the underground, right? Because that is the reality, right? People aren't getting registered with the state and getting their employee ID number from DC. They're just saying, hey, I got this service,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Service offer, you know, repair your computer, mow your lawn, right? This is what it is, pay me cash. And so, Robin, there is a huge amount of the immigrant community that is engaged in work, daily work. And so to be able to talk to those people and, you know, give them a vision or an experience way where we can show them that by coming together, by organizing, by understanding what is the free market, by understanding what is money, right, and how does it grow, and that wealth can never be redistributed. It can only be created.
We're getting into the break, Rahul. We've got 2 minutes to finish when we come back.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
So, Rahul, since we are closing the show with a very short segment, I just want to throw it straight back to you to carry on where you left off.
Thank you, Robin. Yeah, I just want to say that if you're talking to an immigrant community, the heart of being an immigrant is the struggle for independence and self-sufficiency. So I think immigrants innately understand what being in this country is about, and if we can talk to them about really what their American dream is, it's still fresh. It hasn't been sullied and you know, turned into something cynical. Furthermore, Robin, you were asking me about, you know, any tips I can share from my union days. And this is something I would like to mention, that while we all want to come up with that cool political argument or that slogan or that clever, witty thing that we think is going to convince person X, Y, or Z, that really is the dressing. That's the icing on the cake. What is the cake? The cake is accountability, is numbers, is noting down, I talked to these 10 people, what are their phone numbers, let me get them into a database. And this sort of back-end work that we think is so monotonous and boring is actually the most important thing. And it's like this, you know, if anyone out there is fortunate to have Robin speak for them, do you want them him speaking to an audience of 1, 10, or 1,000, right? And that numbers game is up to us, the rank and file, right? We have to build those masses, and we have to take that, you know, the value of that cannot be underplayed.
And in the last minute or so, for full disclosure, you approached, the reason we're having this show, Rahul, is because you approached me some time ago and got involved in Blue Republican, right? And I'm really delighted to have you with the skills and this perspective that you bring, doing some of the things that you're talking about doing. To close the show, is there anything you want to say about what you would like to see with respect to where Blue Republican goes now?
Yeah, absolutely. I see Blue Republican as the first sort of open source, voluntary political union, association, organization where people are coming in regardless of their background, they're learning, they're sharing. And to me, it's the first sustainable model of politics where I see it can be scaled to every state, every community, and really it can become a model for other enterprises that can also help the liberty cause, whether it's, you know,
I'm going to stop you there because that was great. And the show has ended. Thank you so much for joining me this week.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times, WGRR Digital.